Good morning. Welcome to Turfgrass Epistemology. My name is Travis Shattuck. I hope you're doing well. This is the first show of March in 2024. It's March 4th. Beautiful Monday morning in Lexington, Kentucky, finally. It's been a very unusual sort of gray and wet winter. January and February have been very dark, I guess. So it's nice to have some better weather. Grass is growing here. Tall fescue started growing the last couple of days. I turned on my auto mower actually a day or two ago, and then I turned it off, turned it back on today. Sometime I'm actually going to go over like my experience with these auto mowers, because they're very good, but they don't really work. At least mine doesn't really work well in wet weather. If it gets too wet, tends to slip, tends to get stuck. So I turn it off and when it's raining or when it's wet outside. But it's on right now. So grass is growing. Auto mower's running. Still not growing much, but there is some growth. Some of the winter weeds are starting to grow a lot more. And I haven't seen any germination yet of any spring or summer weeds. Quite yet, but I'm checking the temperatures, soil temperatures, and it's going to get above 50 degrees here. I mean, actually it already is, but I don't really care about like one point above 50 degrees or one day. It's not that important to me, but you get 2 or 3 or 4 days where the soil temperature is above 50, 55 degrees, then you better start thinking about pre-emergence pretty quick. And I think we're getting there much sooner this year than we have in the past. So I put out mine yesterday. It was a beautiful day yesterday. So I went ahead and put some out just to be safe. The window here in Lexington on the UK turf grass calendar is March and April. And this year I'm erring on the early side. So first opportunity I got in March, which was yesterday, I went ahead and put some down. That's about the only thing I do in my lawn. Other than a little bit of nitrogen. And I don't even do nitrogen. I don't even really do that much. But I do take care of some pre-emergent applications. I usually do one in the spring. And then depending on how things go, I might do one in the fall too, depending on just the situation or my interest in getting out and doing it. But I probably will apply some nitrogen. I guess, I don't know. We'll see. My grass grows pretty good on its own anyway. It doesn't really need a whole lot of extra help. So I generally will refrain from it if everything looks good and historically it's been fine. But it's that time of year. Seems like it was awful early for me this year, but it's been awful warm too. This winter's been very warm compared to prior years. We only got one major snowfall. That was several weeks ago. I think that was in the end of January. I can't remember now when it was actually, but it was a while ago, and it's going to be warm. What's the weather look like? 60, 70 degrees. So it's going to be 73 today, 67 tomorrow, 60 the next day, 60 the next day, 60, you know, so the next week, the lows are in the low 50s and the highs are in the 60s. So it's coming quick, much sooner than you might think, at least if you're used to putting up pre-emergence and taking care of these winter or these spring things a little later in Lexington. It might be a little earlier this year. So that's what's going on with me. Good morning, Super TA. Brady. Oh, transition zone B. Oh, 7B. So good morning. All about to put down some pre-emergent and no. Yeah. So there you go. Same boat as I was in. Just seems like it's a little early, but when you look at the numbers and you look at the growth, you look at the plant, look at the weeds that are out there now. It's like, you might want to get going. I don't know where you're at in terms of locations for everybody listening, but it seems like it's awful. It's creeping up on us fast. So I'd rather be, you know, 2 weeks early than 3 or 4 days late. So yeah. So 6 Sigma. I don't really remember people's names very well. Pretty bad about that. That's nothing to do with you. It's all about me, which I'll go into in Mental Health Awareness Month. coming up. But I don't recognize the name Six Sigma, but welcome if you've been here before. I'm sorry I don't recognize it. But you ask, do I have an email? My email is in the description of the video. It's in the description of all new videos. You can just scroll down there and look. And it says, I'm curious if you have any interest in doing an Ask Me Anything on your on the Reddit Lawn Care sub. I'm one of the moderators and we have 700,000 members. Okay. One, I don't even know what Reddit is. I actually asked one of my wife's friends, who apparently she's on Reddit all the time. I was like, I don't even know what that is. What is Reddit? And she tried to explain to me it was some sort of like message board that people can upvote or downvote things, and it moves things like up into the channel of the conversation depending on how many upvotes it has or something. I don't know. But my wife and I don't do really any Facebook. We don't do any Reddit. We don't do any, we just don't do any social stuff like that online at all. But I'm not opposed to it. I mean, if I, you know, I'd be open to it if that's what you're interested in. You just got to send me an email. It's in the description of the video. It's travisshaddix@gmail.com. And I can look into it. But I'm always like a little hesitant. Like, I don't know what's appropriate and not appropriate on these website boards and things. Like, someone will say, well, I'm on this app or whatever. And I'm like, okay. And come to find out, it's like an adult app or something. I don't even know. So I'm quite out of date when it comes to those things. So if it's an appropriate thing to do, I'm happy to pursue it. Yeah, and I appreciate the interest in getting more exposure for this channel, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm open to it. Just give me a shout out on an email and we'll talk. Okay, so a couple things I want to go over first. We have a very important article today, and I'm going to get out of here in an hour. And this article is really important. It's very easy to understand, and it's very important, and it's going to set the stage for the remainder of this or the rest of this month. And we're going to be going over potassium for all of March. And I've hit a couple papers really, really early on. Some of the first episodes I did were on potassium or nitrogen potassium ratios. I think I even went over the review article by Frank and Kurtal on potassium, if I'm not mistaken. That's one of the very, very early ons when no one was even watching the channel. And so I may end up going over those articles again, but this month is going to be a lot about potassium on cool season and warm season grasses. And this article here is one of the more recent articles. It's 20 years old, but it's still one of the more recent articles. And I'm going to go over it because it really has a good literature review of past literature. And it has some graphs in here that I think are a little bit more meaningful for like the average person. And you can probably grasp the information much easier in the graphs that these authors use. You don't have to get overwhelmed by, you know, trying to find your way through all the data. Yeah, see, I just turned my auto mower on and it already got stuck. I mean, that's how long it took. I turned it on when I came on. That's how long I've been on, for 10 minutes, and my auto mower is already stuck because it's wet out. It was rained a couple days ago. Anyway. So anyway, I'm going to go over that article. But when it comes to the channel, let me go over a couple things about the channel first, is that I've been going back and forth on whether or not I'm going to do memberships and everything else. And, you know, I've settled on what I'm going to do. And so I'm going to just briefly explain it, what I'm leaning towards doing. But one, I'd like to get y'all's input. First of all, whether or not, you know, you want to provide that input's up to you. But if you want to provide some input as to how the channel should move or what you're looking for, please let me know. And I'd be happy to consider any recommendations you might have about, you know, what you would like to see and what you'd like to get out of a membership. But the reality is I've done 84 or 85 podcasts since the very end of August. So if you do the math, it's one episode about every 2 days or whatever it is, 6 months or whatever the length of months are. And the intent was to do a podcast in a way that you can just kind of hang back and listen to it and either listen on the podcast platforms or watch it on YouTube and interact and or just, you know, chill out and just listen and learn. That was one intent. And we're doing that. But another objective I had was to take the content and then split it up after the fact and then load those videos as standalone, more easily digestible videos. And I do that a little bit with when I'm doing a video review or an article, periodical review or something like that. And you'll see these videos come out in like 3-minute sections or 15-minute videos, a little bit easier to follow, and you can watch it and move on about your day. You don't have to hang out and listen for an hour. But I also wanted to do that with the articles themselves. I wanted to just cut out the introduction and then, you know, briefly the results and go to the conclusions and try to get that in about a 10-minute video. That was my intent early on, was to be able to do that. But I've realized with the other videos that I've done, the 5 and 10 minute videos, those are pretty easy to do because I just cut out sort of the meandering and then in my content, my language, just cut that out and it's a video and I can put it out. And right now I think there's 15 videos already finished that I haven't released yet. Those are easy to do. But when it comes to the article, I have to sit and listen for the entire article and then just cut out the content that is perhaps not as meaningful or pertinent, and so that I can reduce the whole video down to about a 10-minute, you know, video. And that takes time. And I don't have time because I'm doing this 4 days a week. I'm creating all this content. And so I don't have the time to back up and go over my past videos and make the videos more condensed. But I want to do that. And I've had a lot of feedback from you all, and I appreciate the feedback saying, hey, I like your content, but I can't sit and listen for an hour, hour and a half. Or I like the content, but it's hard for me to find what I'm looking for throughout an hour video. I have to kind of search and I can't seem to find it because, you know, it's a long video. So I'm going to condense all these articles. I'm going to condense them down to 10 minutes. I'm going to try to shoot for 10 minutes. But I need time to do that. I can't do it while I'm here doing this four days a week, okay? Four podcasts a week. So where I'm going with all that is I need to reduce the amount of time I'm creating content, at least it's long enough to give me time to catch up. Does that make sense? So I'm going to reduce the content I'm putting out when I load or open up the memberships, so that I have time to actually catch up with all this stuff. I have to go back over 84 episodes. So 84 hours I got to listen to and cut out and create 80 something videos of just the article, which I think would be more useful for just the average casual viewer on YouTube, because they see an hour on the timestamp or whatever. I'm not gonna watch that for an hour. And I get that from the emails you all send me and the comments you send me in the videos. I get that. I understand it. Okay. So my direction is cut the content I'm sending out right now by half. So I'll do one morning show a week and one evening show a week. And then I'll have time to catch up on all the past videos. And when I catch up on all the past videos, then I'll reconsider, you know, adding in another morning show or whatever. I hope that makes sense to everybody. And so I know everybody likes to watch in the morning. There's a lot of people like to come here on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday morning and listen and learn. And I'm not going to do away with that completely, but I'm going to have to eliminate a couple of those shows, at least for whatever length of time I need to catch up. And then I'll reconsider opening those back up and continuing. The disadvantage of that is there's so many articles that need to be covered. If I only do 2 a week, it's going to take freaking 5 years to get through these videos, through these articles, because there's just so many. I mean, just potassium alone, I could do one video a week for a year or 2 years, probably 2 years, 100 articles just on potassium alone. So you can see my interest is not to do that. I want to do it, you know, I want to do it more quickly. I don't want to wait for a year or 2 years just, you know, getting all these articles. But I just don't have time to do what I want to do because I'm doing all the content. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to cut it in half. Probably starting in April, because I'm going to be gone for a week in April. Spring break for my kids is in April. So that might be a good time to, I'll be gone for that week. And then when I come back, maybe it'll be like a morning show and an evening show. And the morning show will very likely be a members only show. So when I open up the membership, the content for that show live will be viewable only to the members. And then many, many months later, whenever I get to it, I'll load the small pieces of that particular members only video into, you know, a publicly available 10 or 15 minute segment, if that makes sense. And then the evening show will be public, just normal. It'll be a normal evening show. And on that note, there was a change. I put the evening show on Wednesday intentionally for several reasons. One, I'm not going to do it on Friday and Saturday. I have a family. Okay. I have a life. I'm definitely not going to do it on Friday and Saturday. And then the Grass Factor guys were doing their show on Thursday nights. And Thursday night football's on Thursday night. So during football season, I have no interest in doing it on Thursday night. And so I put mine on Wednesday night because I thought that was sort of a good time slot. I was available. It didn't conflict with anything else. But apparently the Grass Factor guys are moving theirs from Thursday to my time slot on Wednesday, apparently, is what I've heard. I don't know. And if they do that, that's actually better for me because I'd rather do mine on Thursday anyway. I don't want to do it. I don't want to do two shows on Wednesday. Okay. So I know I'm cutting that Wednesday morning show out for a little bit here, but when I bring it back, I don't want to do a Wednesday morning show and then turn around and do a Wednesday night show. I'd much rather do a Wednesday morning show and then do a Thursday night show anyway. So I'll be moving the Wednesday night show to Thursday night. That way I don't conflict with with the Grass Factor guys. And it also provides me, when I do have the Wednesday morning show back, I don't have to do two in the same day. So expect that probably starting in April as well. Okay. That's the update on the channel. I'm going to get started here because this article is really important and it's going to take me a little time to get to it. And I don't want to screw it up. Last thing is, the podcasts. So if you're watching this on YouTube and you prefer to watch on YouTube, then great. But if you prefer to listen to it on a podcast, if you're listening to this right now on a podcast, you might notice there's some advertising placements throughout the podcasts. I guess I was allowed or afforded the ability to open up advertising, I guess. I don't know how all that works, but I clicked a button. And so if you notice there's some advertising on there, so be it. I have to figure out some way to pay for this. But if it becomes too much, you're like, hey, Travis, I get it. You got to pay for things, but it's just too much. Let me know. And I'll make adjustments to the advertising and we'll move on. Just so everybody's on the same page, is that all of this is paid for by my wife. Let's be honest here, okay? The microphones, the cameras, the computers, the lights, the actual podcast payment platform costs money every year for me to actually load those on and keep those hosted on. That costs me money. And my wife pays for all that. So that my goal is to have any income or revenue from the podcast at least get to the point where it pays for itself instead of my wife paying for all this stuff. So you might see some advertising in that, and you might see, advertising on that. And then of course the memberships on YouTube, whatever the memberships come in on YouTube, if there are any members on YouTube. When I open that up, the intent is to have this sort of at least a little bit self-sustainable to help pay for all this equipment and the, you know, all this stuff to keep the show going. So that's the intent. If you listen to a podcast and you hear some advertising, that's the intent, is just to help pay for itself. It's not a lot of money. It's only, you know, the whole thing here is probably $1,000 a year. But still got to pay for it somehow. If the podcast can do that on its own, I'd prefer to do it that way. So that's what to expect. Okay. Let's get into the article. Okay, this article, as I mentioned, is a very good article. It has a very good literature review. There's a lot of green on here, only because I'm starting off potassium kind of from scratch here, and I want to use this article to set the stage as to what generally occurs with potassium in turfgrass systems. And then on Wednesday night, I'll probably end up doing a presentation like I would do at a lecture. So I'm going to lecture probably on Wednesday night about potassium. So it'll be more like a slideshow sort of thing on Wednesday night, is what I'm thinking. And then that'll also sort of introduce potassium for this month. Okay. So let's get started. This article is entitled Kentucky Bluegrass Response to Potassium and Nitrogen Fertilization. And it's by Fitzpatrick and Gallard. Now, Carl Gallard, I believe it now, is emeritus from University of Connecticut. I think, yeah, University of Connecticut, and he's done bukus of work on soils and nutrients and turf grasses and so forth. And he still has some publications he submits even now as emeritus. And most of it's on the soil testing and newer interpretations of resin tests and things like that for nitrates and things like that. So he's still very active, even if he is in an emeritus stage. And you'll see his name probably periodically throughout the potassium month here. And so we're going to get started. This was published in Crop Science in 2004. So if you go to crops.org, you can download the abstract or read the abstract. And if you're a member, then you can download the article. This is a pretty important article. And as I mentioned, there's some graphs in here that I really like. But I'm going to read most of this green stuff because it's really the introduction and it sets the stage for the month. So previous studies report differing potassium effects on grass growth and quality. Turner and Hummel, 1992, found few beneficial growth effects from potassium applications to cool season grasses, even when extractable soil cake extract concentrations were relatively low. I think this Turner and Hummel that he's citing is actually an abstract. If I remember correctly, I don't recall exactly, but I think that's an abstract, so I won't go over that. But most of the citations in here, I will go over as a standalone video, particularly the Sartain 93 paper. So Sartain 93 noted in studies of hybrid turf Bermuda grass that applications of K improved clipping yields when clippings were removed, while similar K applications on perennial ryegrass did not influence clipping yields. 3 years of potassium for common Bermuda grass were needed before a forage yield response was observed by Nelson in 83. I'll go over the Nelson paper as well. Inadequate exchangeable K in the soil resulted in reduced forage yield from selected cool season grasses, the Weed and 74 paper. I don't think I'm going to do that paper, I don't think. In contrast, potassium applications alone had no effect on turf Kentucky bluegrass grown in soils with low soil test K values independent of the K rate, potassium rate applied. That's from Scott up and Dr. Ebden up in 1999. Now, I will go over that paper. So Dr. Ebden is a wizard when it comes to math. So I will definitely go over the Ebden 99 paper when I get probably this month or probably this. Hang on a second, guys. 1 second. I gotta see what this is. Give me 1 second. I'll be right back. Hang on. Oh man, it's a Jehovah's Witness. I would miss that. I love that when they come to my door. Dang it. Wrong time. I'll go into that at some other time, but I used to like shut the door on Jehovah's Witnesses and so forth, and now I just sit down and talk to them. It's fantastic. And they stopped coming to my house actually. But they're back. Bad timing. I should tell them to come back in like 2 hours. Anyway, so I'll go over the Scott Ebden paper. Okay, the need for potassium by turf grasses may be affected by nitrogen availability. Oh, just real quick, so the previous paragraph is basically saying that a lot of times nothing happens. A lot of the previous literature is indicating we don't really see a whole lot happen, and when we did, we had to apply it for 3 years, and we had to do it on low K soils and so forth. But even on low K soils, they're finding that not a lot was happening, and that's going to be a theme of this month, really. Okay. The need for potassium by turf grasses may be affected by nitrogen availability. Schmidt and Bruninger, I think it's what it's called, in 1981, reported that fertilization of Kentucky bluegrass with 6 pounds of nitrogen significantly decreased leaf potassium concentrations when compared with half that rate. Increasing the amount of nitrogen applied to Kentucky bluegrass without a corresponding increase in potassium application reduced concentrations of leaf potassium. Carol and Petrovic paper. I don't think I'm going to do that paper either. I can't remember that particular paper. But when nitrogen and potassium were applied in a nutrient solution experiment, increasing potassium above 100 parts per million generally had an adverse effect on most growth measurements of Kentucky bluegrass with 65 parts per million nitrogen. So in other words, they're saying that in some cases when the potassium got so high, we actually saw an adverse effect. And that is going to be, again, a very consistent theme in this month. Is that somehow, I don't know how, but somehow in our industry, this this concept got out that you, oh, potassium's not going to harm anything. Just keep applying potassium just to make sure you have it. That's not true. The evidence is clear on that issue, is that excessive amounts of potassium clearly increase the risk of stress on the plant. And I know we like to use potassium in the advertising, particularly YouTubers sometimes say, potassium is a stress element. Potassium is the all-around element. But I agree, potassium is a stress element. It will increase stress on the plant if applied at too high of a rate in certain situations with certain types of turf grass. So we're going to debunk a lot of that nonsense when it comes to, oh, potassium's harmless. It's only going to help. It increases our resistance to some stresses. In some cases, that can be true, particularly in winter kill situations. In some drought situations, that can happen. But it only happens when the potassium in the soil is already low. We're going to find that throughout this month, okay? When you don't know what the potassium level is, or your potassium is already fine in the turf grass, and you keep applying more and more and more, we're going to find in many, many cases, whether it's on cool season grasses or on warm season grasses, we're going to find that increasing potassium can definitely increase your risk of stress when it comes to diseases, for sure. Okay, so keep that in mind as we move through this month. This suggests that the need to increase potassium when the amount of nitrogen is increased. So when you're applying more and more nitrogen, you may need to apply a little bit more potassium depending on your situation. That there's some literature to support that. Plants will typically absorb more potassium than is required for optimum growth. Now, I've talked about this a little bit before. If you investigated it precisely enough and repped it out enough, you could probably find this luxury consumption concept is probably the case with many nutrients. But the term luxury consumption sort of connotes some sort of benefit. It's luxurious that you have more potassium in the leaf tissue, and somehow that's going to be beneficial. That's probably not the case in many, many situations. Okay. It means that you're taking up more potassium than is actually being consumed. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's beneficial to the plant. Okay, and we're going to go over that a little bit more in detail this month. The excessive absorption of potassium is termed luxury consumption. However, recent studies indicate that frequent mowed turf grass may not exhibit luxury consumption. Miller 99 reported no increase in tissue potassium concentrations at applications greater than a pound and a half of potassium per month in studies with hybrid Bermuda grass grown on loamy sand soils and sand peat root zones. Also, Sartain 2002 noted that the application of additional potassium above a rate of 2 pounds every 3 months to hybrid Bermuda grass did not result in increase in tissue K. So they're showing, he's going over articles that did not show that this luxury consumption was, you know, either found or beneficial. Similar results were obtained by Snyder and Cesar in 2000. I'll go over all these papers, indicating that increasing potassium fertilization on hybrid Bermuda grass relative to nitrogen did not provide proportional increases in tissue K. Okay, so in that, and I've gone over that paper before, and if I can get Dr. Snyder on here, I'll have him, you know, help me on that paper as well. But basically, they found that there was a little bit of benefit on quality if the potassium was depleted to such a degree that the turf grass was deficient in potassium. But when you applied a little bit of potassium, you do see a response there. But when you apply more and more and more, the tissue K didn't go up and up and up. So this luxury consumption concept was not found with Snyder's Cesar 2000 paper. Luxury consumption of potassium was not observed with Kentucky bluegrass turf with increased potassium fertilization. And that was the Schmidt and Bruninger 81 paper. Most of the totals, and so this is on this next paragraph, if you're listening to this and you're kind of spaced out and working or whatever, listen up just real quick, because this next paragraph is going to lead into some other papers. And I don't think that this dynamic is appreciated to the degree it needs to be appreciated, because other professors, other scientists have actually drilled down deeper into this next paragraph and found that indeed there is some truth to it. And we need to consider this, okay, when we're talking about potassium fertilization, because if you don't consider it, and you're applying potassium when you don't need to, that can increase things like microdocium and so forth on some cool season grasses. So listen up. Most of the total potassium in soils is associated with primary minerals and non-exchangeable forms. So when he says non-exchangeable, what he's saying is, well, this isn't, okay, this isn't exactly the case, but for our pragmatic approach, what he's saying is it's not really going to be measured on a soil test per se. Okay, a soil test is going to take some of the exchangeable nitrogen or some of the exchangeable potassium, pretty much all of the potassium in solution. It's going to measure that. The non-exchangeable is the potassium that's in the minerals themselves that the soil test will not extract. Okay, and he's saying that most of the potassium in the soil is in a primary mineral in non-exchangeable form. Okay. So it's not it's not going to be immediately exchangeable into the soil solution. Non-exchangeable soil K is thought to be slowly released into the soil solution and to contribute only a minor amount of plant available potassium during the growing season. Then this, remember, this was published in 2004, 20 years ago. Okay, so 20 years ago, this was the case where we believed it was a very limited impact, very limited amount of potassium would actually be released and taken up from the plant from primary minerals. That the amount of potassium that is not measured on a soil test. Okay. Relatively high amounts of exchangeable potassium and non-exchangeable. Oh, wait. Studies by Gazelle et al. 2001, however, indicate a strong positive correlation between the amounts of non-exchangeable and the exchangeable potassium. Relatively high amounts of exchangeable and non-exchangeable potassium in the soil may account for a lack of response by plants when fertilized potassium is applied, or when fertilizer potassium is applied. So this paragraph was written 20 years ago, or published 20 years ago, and the evidence we've found since this paper, and even some before this paper, but since this paper has done nothing but support this postulation. The postulation is we're doing a soil test, pulling off some of the potassium from the exchange sites and from the solution and so forth, and we're measuring that, and we're trying to correlate that to a response. And if it says it's low, we're applying potassium. When in fact, the soil test is not accounting for some of the other potassium that might be being mineralized from primary minerals. The thought process was that there wasn't going to be a lot of potassium being mineralized, and it's not really going to contribute to plant uptake of potassium if it's in a primary mineral form. But he's postulating that, in fact, it might actually contribute to it. And later on, he's actually going to show that it probably did. And the studies that have been published since then have more clearly concluded that, in fact, that is occurring. Okay, even in sands. All right. And we're going to get into that in this paper a little bit. Okay, so we get to the objectives. Because potassium fertilization to turfgrass has produced inconsistent results in previously reported experiments, further study was warranted to determine if potassium application to Kentucky bluegrass would elicit growth or quality responses. Therefore, the objective of the study was to determine the effects of differing potassium fertilization rates across varying nitrogen rates and clipping management on Kentucky bluegrass clipping yield, turf quality, tissue potassium concentration, and nitrogen recovery and use efficiency. Okay. As I said, it's a very good study. So, we're going to get into it. Let me see. So the clumsy carpenter, do we need to worry about crabgrass germination if freezing temps are future or in the future forecast? I don't know. I'm not a weed biologist, but what I would do is I would go to the website of these land grant institutions and see who the weed biologist is nearest to you, and see what they've published in the extension publications, and or just call them or email them and ask that question to a weed biologist. They're going to know that like the back of their hand. They'll be able to answer that question with a great deal of confidence. But I'm not a weed biologist. I apologize, clumsy carpenter, but that's not my area. If I get into the literature and I review a paper, then we can discuss it in that context. But I don't know enough about it to give a confident answer. Okay, the materials and methods. A field experiment was conducted at the University of Connecticut's Plant Science Research and Teaching Farms in Storrs, Connecticut in 2000 and 2001. The soil was a Paxton fine sandy loam. pH was 5.1. So I'm showing this particularly because the pH was 5.1. Okay, they actually did apply some lime on the soil, but it's 5.1. The turf's growing fine. Okay, the modified Morgan, the extract was used for calcium, magnesium, phosphorus, and potassium. And they found that the calcium was 643, the magnesium was 89, the phosphorus was 4, and the potassium was 75 parts per million. So these values, according to the University of Connecticut, are considered medium for calcium, medium high for magnesium, medium for phosphorus, and low for potassium. Okay. That's going to become important because the point of me showing that is that he chose, these authors chose a location that was low in, or for potassium research, that was already low in potassium according to the standard soil test extract that they use in Connecticut. This, in this case, it was a modified Morgan extract. Okay. So, you know, they picked the right location. Main plots were two clipping treatments. They either returned the clippings or they removed the clippings. Subplots were four rates of potassium, either zero. I got to convert this over to English. All right. I should have done this beforehand. I'm just going to ballpark these numbers. It was either zero, a pound and a half of potassium. Oh, goodness. Hang on. I'm sorry. I should have got this right the first time. All right. Hang on. I'll get it. So 1.6 pounds of potassium. 3.3 pounds of potassium. Or, I know 243. Or 5 pounds of potassium. So it was either 0, 1.6, 3.3, or 5 pounds of potassium with four nitrogen rates, either 0, 2 pounds of nitrogen, 4 pounds of nitrogen, or, well, that's 6 pounds of nitrogen? Wow, they're putting it out. Yeah, 6 pounds of nitrogen. Applied in split applications. Okay, so they split apply these the nitrogen and the potassium. Just remember, the potassium is going out at 0, 1.6, 3.3, or 5 pounds per year, okay? And then the amount that went out per application was split based upon their application regime, which they have here. I guess I'll read it. I wasn't going to, but I guess I should. So during each growing season, the split fertilizer applications were applied by hand in May and September for the 2-pound N rate. In May, June, September, and October for the 4-pound N rate. And then in May, June, July, August, and September, and October for the 6-pound N rate. So they split all that up evenly. The nitrogen, now here's going to be important here, because at the end, we're going to find that, we're going to find what we found. Okay, I'm not going to spoil it yet. But at the end, there's going to be something happen with potassium and nitrogen. But I'm going to argue that their rationale as to why they saw what they saw probably is less strong than what I would argue. And so I'll get to that, but that's a horrible way to explain it. I'm trying to explain it without giving it all away. But so listen to the end sources and the K source. The end source was a 60-40 mixture of soluble and slow release, from ammonium nitrate being the 60% soluble and polymer coated sulfur coated urea being the 40% slow. So very standard ammonium nitrate. Well, you're not going to use ammonium nitrate now, but ammonium nitrate and polymer coated or sulfur coated urea. And then the K source was potassium sulfate. So for those of you who know the channel and are familiar with what I talk about and so forth with sulfur, you kind of know where I'm going with all this, with the response to potassium, because he used potassium sulfate. Okay, so I'll explain that when we get to it. Plots were established in May 1999 with the Kentucky Bluegrass blend, and it goes through all the different blends of Kentucky Bluegrass and Midnight and Adelphi and American Kentucky Bluegrass. Then he had 5% creeping red fescue and 5% chewing fescue. So he had a blend of Kentucky Bluegrass and some red fescues and chewing fescues in there, okay? And that was established in 1999. Tissue samples were analyzed for total nitrogen concentration. When they took tissue sampling, potassium was extracted from tissue samples with a very unusual extracted method. He argues why they use this particular method in this paragraph, which is fine. I'm sure there's probably nothing wrong with the method. I've just never heard of it and never used it, which, again, doesn't mean anything. I'm sure it's valid. But normally we would do a digestion, but he argues that because the number of samples, this one was quicker and valid to use. So, I mean, it's fine. Just, I found it curious that he used a and it's not unusual, just use a extracting method I've never heard of, but it's fine. Soil samples were taken from each plot in November 2000, in October 2001, in May 2001, in May 2002, and analyzed for modified Morgan extractable potassium. Visual quality ratings were on 1 to 9, with 6 as being the minimal acceptable. And the treatment effects of clipping, dry matter yield, apparent nitrogen recovery, and nitrogen use efficiency were analyzed with repeated measures, which is what you should do. So it's all good, okay? So that was the materials and method. So let me just explain exactly what they're doing. Make sure everybody's on the same page. They're in Connecticut on a blend of Kentucky bluegrass on a low potassium soil, a soil that is currently interpreted as being low using the modified Morgan extract. Okay. They're removing clippings or they're leaving clippings on the plots. So that's one treatment. Then they're applying 4 different rates of potassium and four different rates of nitrogen. Okay. Ranging from 0 to 6 pounds of nitrogen and 0 to 5 pounds of potassium. And it's a factorial design. So all the combinations are accounted for. Then they do tissue sampling for nitrogen. They do tissue sampling for potassium, which I didn't mention, but they do tissue sample for potassium. They do soil. I did mention tissue sample for potassium. Then they do soil analysis for potassium. And then they do quality ratings. And then they'll do dry matter yield and nitrogen recovery and all these things. And they're in Connecticut about 20 years ago, 2000, 2001, something like that. Okay, guys? So we're going to see in this this particular paper what the effect is of potassium as nitrogen rates change, what the effect is of potassium as tissue is removed or not removed, and a variety of other things as well, okay? But the graphs in here are what I want to focus on. I'm not going to really read too much of the results. I'm going to show the results primarily in the graphs form because it's one of those things where a picture tells 1,000 words, really. And I think it'll make more sense using the graphs. But I'm going to read some of it, but not all of it, okay? Now, you'll notice there's a lot of red in this document, okay? The reason that when I highlight something in red, it means I'll make sure I don't miss that, okay? Because it's really important what they said. And there's a lot of red in here, okay? It's the reason this paper is important. We got to make sure we don't miss these red points. So the first, you see right here, there's already 3 reds on this page right now. Clipping, dry matter yield, and quality. This is under the results, okay? Applied fertilizer potassium had no effect on clipping dry matter yields. So whether you applied 0 pounds of potassium or 5 pounds of potassium with or without nitrogen on a soil that already was known to be low in potassium, then the applying potassium had no effect. The dry matter yield was the same whether you bought potassium and you put it out, or you didn't buy potassium, put it out. Dry matter yield was the same. Okay. Positive yield responses were a function of increasing nitrogen rates and returning clippings. So when you applied nitrogen, you saw a response. When you returned clippings, you saw a response. But when you applied potassium, they didn't see a response in terms of dry matter yield. The lack of response to potassium fertilization was surprising considering the initial soil extractable potassium concentration was 75 parts per million using the modified Morgan, which is classified as low under our present soil test ratings. Even at the high nitrogen potassium treatment combination, which decreased extractable soil potassium, yields were comparable to yields obtained at the higher potassium combination with nitrogen. So basically what they're saying is the high nitrogen in 0K. So even at the high nitrogen in 0K treatment combination with decreased extractable soil potassium concentration. So in other words, when they did not apply potassium and they applied a lot of nitrogen, they reduced the potassium in the soil. That was the result. Even under those scenarios, the yields were comparable to the yields obtained at the highest potassium rate combinations with nitrogen. So even when we're removing and depleting potassium or harvesting potassium out of the soil, at least under this scenario, they still didn't see a response in terms of dry matter yield when they applied it. Okay? So you're not seeing a benefit. In fact, I'm going to put up a scoreboard for this whole month, and I forgot to do it today. But I'm going to put up a scoreboard that says negative response, no response, positive response for potassium. And we're going to count how many articles show a negative response to potassium, no response to potassium, or a positive response to potassium. And I'm going to let you know just now, you know, spoiler alert, there's not going to be a whole lot in that positive potassium response column. I'm just letting you know, okay? You just don't see a turfgrass response to potassium. You know, sometimes we'll see a turfgrass response to not applying potassium. Sounds strange when I say that, but when conditions line up just right for winter kill or for some drought issues, every now and then you'll see a positive response to potassium in those situations. But if you're putting out potassium in a normal situation on a normal lawn and things look fine and, you know, normal time of year, and you think you're going to see some benefit to applying that potassium, you're kidding yourself. You probably will never in your lifetime see a turfgrass response to applied potassium. It's only when the conditions are just right to where winter kill will happen on low-K soils that you might see a benefit to applying potassium in those situations. Or some drought situations, when it would occur on low-K soils, you might see a little bit of risk reduction, okay? But you will almost never in your life ever see a beneficial response to applying potassium on turf grasses. It is so rare. You might as well go to Las Vegas and, you know, put everything on black 30 or whatever the numbers. I mean, you have basically zero chance. Okay, I'm going to show papers that do show a positive response, but I'm going to contextualize those papers. They were designed intentionally to deplete the potassium so low that eventually there's a good chance you'd see a potassium response when you applied it. But under normal conditions, that just doesn't ever happen. Potassium's not going to really ever get that low, even in Florida with sandy soils. So don't come to me and say, well, potassium's low on my putting green because it's sandy, or it's low on my fairway because it's sandy. Okay, might be low. I don't care. What I care about is if you're going to see a response to applying potassium. You might think it's low, but we just almost never see a response to it. Okay, I'll keep going. No positive effect was observed for potassium on turf quality, and positive effects were a function only of increasing nitrogen rates and returning clippings. Table 2. Increasing potassium rates significantly decreased quality at the highest N rate, but the decrease in absolute rating values was 6.5 to 6.4, which probably has very little, if any, practical consequence, which I agree. You're never going to see that. 6.5 to 6.4, you're never going to see that. But it was a significant reduction. So what he's saying is there was a significant reduction, but biologically speaking, you're never actually going to be able to see that reduction. And I'm going to show that graph, okay? But he measured in this article a reduction in turf quality as a result of applying potassium at the highest N rates. Okay? So this isn't anything new. It might be new to you if you're listening to this for the first time. You're not aware potassium can actually cause problems. But this isn't anything new in the literature. I mean, I can show you potassium reductions in turf quality from the application of potassium going back into the 80s, maybe even the 70s. Okay, I don't know how in the world it got into our lexicon that potassium is relatively harmless. You're not going to cause any problems, so why not apply it just to make sure that you always have enough of it because there may be a benefit. I'll go into that at some point, but that's basically the agronomic equivalent of Pascal's wager. Why not just do it just in case? Well, here's a perfect example why you shouldn't do it just in case, because you're going to have potentially a deleterious effect that you just didn't realize it can actually occur. Okay, let's go to the last paragraph of the tissue potassium concentrations. So now we're in tissue potassium. There was no significant correlation between tissue potassium concentrations and clipping dry matter yield or quality across the 2 years of the study. All but one sample had tissue potassium concentrations of 10 parts from 10 milligrams. This is a typo. Greater than 10. Yeah, that's not right. That's got to be a typo. This should say greater than 10 grams per kilogram. All but one of the samples had tissue potassium concentration. Yeah, there's no way this is 10 milligrams per kilogram. This is 10 grams per kilogram or 1%. And this seems to have been adequate for Kentucky bluegrass needs, regardless of the treatment. So, I better look at that, because if that's 10, let me look at that, make sure that I'm right. 10, figure four. Let me go down to figure four, just make sure I'm not screwing this up. Figure four. Oh, here's figure four. Yeah, right here. Grams per kilogram. Yeah. So, and here's the 10. Yeah, so there was only this one point. Yeah, so I'm right. That's a typo. Yeah, so this 10 milligrams per kilogram is not right. That should be grams per kilogram. So anyway, only one sample was below 10 grams per kilogram, 1%. All of them were above 1%. And what he's saying is this appears to be adequate for Kentucky bluegrass, regardless of the treatment. Everything was above 1%, and regardless of the treatment, everything was fine. I mean, he's going to say this multiple times throughout this. Okay, so the discussion, that was the result. So I'm going to show the graphs now so that we're all a little bit, you know, familiar with what this is. What I'm looking at is a 3D response panel, or response, what do they call it? Surface response graph. And it's a predicted fall extractable soil potassium compared to the nitrogen rate and the potassium rate. So it's three-dimensional. We're looking at nitrogen rates on one of the x-axes. I guess that's the Z, or I guess that's the x-axis. K on the y-axis, and then I guess fall extractables on the y-axis. I forget how the three-dimensional axes are denoted. But we're looking at three variables, or two independent variables being K rate and N rate, and then one dependent variable being the fall extractable potassium. And we see the surface, this three-dimensional surface bending. And the fall extractable potassium is not rocket science. Basically, when you have zero nitrogen and you move it up to 6 pounds of nitrogen, you see with no potassium, you see less potassium being extracted. Okay. Potassium extraction goes down if you don't apply any potassium and you apply high rates of nitrogen. Okay. Pretty normal in the data. I was looking to see if this was. No. Okay. When you don't apply any nitrogen and you apply up to 5 pounds of potassium, of course, the extractable potassium goes up. Okay. Again, not rocket science. And when you apply both nitrogen at high rates and potassium at high rates, the potassium doesn't go up as high when you don't apply any nitrogen, but it still goes up. Okay. So that's how to read this particular surface, 3D surface graph. And it's similar, that was in the fall extractable K and the spring extractable K. You basically see the same chart. Increasing rates of nitrogen with no potassium deplete the potassium in the spring. Increasing potassium with no nitrogen increase the extractable potassium in the spring. And if you maximize both in high nitrogen and high potassium, you still see an increase. It's just not as high as when the nitrogen was zero. Now let's go to the next graph. Now this is, in my view, in my opinion, this is the most important graph. So if you're watching and you're kind of like, just kind of like halfway listening, I want you to see this graph here. So if you can, just give me a couple seconds here, maybe 5 minutes, and I'll explain this graph. This is the same sort of panel, surface. It's a three-dimensional surface, and we have nitrogen rate, just like the last one, nitrogen rate on one of the axes, K rate on the other axes, and then turf quality on the, I guess it's the Z axis. I can't remember, the one going up. Now, when we apply no nitrogen and we increase the rates of potassium, look at the quality ratings. It starts at 5.1 with no nitrogen and no potassium on a low potassium soil, and we apply as much as 5 pounds of potassium, and the quality went from 5.1 to 5.1. When no nitrogen was applied, went from 5.1 to 5.1. Okay? So in other words, turf quality did not change. The only thing that changed was our budget got reduced. our money that we have access to got depleted because we bought all this potassium and put it out. And we didn't see, we literally saw zero ROI on our potassium application. None. When it came to quality ratings. Quality did not go up or down when no nitrogen was applied and we kept increasing the potassium. Now, let's go all the way up to the high rate of nitrogen. At 6 pounds of nitrogen, the quality rating, as we already mentioned in the text, was about 6.5. I'm right over here, 6.5. at 6 pounds of N. When we increase the potassium from 0 pounds of potassium up to 5 pounds of potassium, just as the author stated, it went from 6.5 down to 6.4. So the quality, and this was a significant decline, the quality went down. Now, there's no way I would be, there's just no way you would ever be able to see a difference between 6.5 and 6.4 in the field. Not even the most well-trained scientist could ever pull that out. So biologically, this is an insignificant reduction. Okay. It's not real. It's not practical in any way. Statistically, okay, I'll give it to you. You saw a reduction. Pragmatically, who cares? You're never going to see that. Okay. But you definitely didn't see an increase. You didn't see a benefit. So there was on turf quality ratings, these authors found zero benefit to applying zero potassium all the way up to 5 pounds of potassium. None on turf quality. Even when you applied a little bit more nitrogen, a little bit more nitrogen, you applied a little bit more potassium, nothing. I want you to take a screenshot of this if you want to. Let me back out so you get the whole thing. Well, dang it. Can't seem to get it all in the... That's the best I can do to get the whole thing in. It's just so rare to see a quality response as a result of increasing potassium. I can't express it enough. Very, very rare. You have to have exceedingly unique conditions to see a benefit to applying potassium to turf grass, a quality benefit. And like I said, I'm going to get into the winter kill. I'm going to get into the drought stuff. I'll get into that where there will be a benefit. Okay. I'm not going to say there, you know, that won't happen. There's evidence to support that for sure. But this concept of constantly applying potassium just in case I'm going to have winter kill, I'm going to keep throwing out the potassium. That's not a BMP any longer, guys, because your risk of other problems occurring goes up greatly, okay? Especially on soils that are already adequately supplied with potassium from the parent material, okay? There's a really good paper that I'll go into probably towards the end. Well, I don't know when I'm going to go into it, but it really goes into the influence of the parent material on potassium supply much more detail than this paper does. That kind of more clearly exemplifies or shows the risk to applying too much potassium. So I'm going to go down to the next couple of graphs. I just wanted to show these graphs here, these panels. I'm looking at K rate versus concentration in the tissue, and we're looking at over months. We're looking at probably 10 panels here on the same figure. We're looking at the May, June, July, July, August, September, October, and so forth. K rate is on the x-axis, and K concentration in the tissue is on the y-axis. So K rate is the independent variable, and then the potassium in the tissue is the dependent variable in this case. And you'll see L, Q, and C. This means linear, quadratic, or cubic. And if that's on the graph, that means that there was a significant, was significant on that month, meaning that that model was adequately predicted displayed, or there was an, how do I explain that? The model, yeah, predicted. The model was the correct model to predict what would occur, right? It basically is the way to say that. 1 month, there was no significant difference. But the reason I'm showing this panel when it comes to the tissue K is that notice in 1 year, we have year 2000 at the top panels and year 2001 in the bottom panels. And you'll notice occasionally some similarities between years. So May and June, you see the potassium in the tissue go up as the potassium applied goes up too. So it goes from 0 to 5 pounds. And you see some potassium go up and then it starts going back down at the highest K rate. And you'll see the same thing in the next year. It kind of goes up to about 2.4% and it goes back down to about 1.8% or something like that. So you see some similarities in May and June, but notice in the other months, you don't see much similarities from 1 year to the next. And the next year you see an increase go up from, when it goes from 0 to 1.6 pounds, you see an increase in potassium and then nothing in June, July. And then the next year you see it do nothing until the highest rates of potassium go out. And then you'll see inconsistencies from year to year for the given month that it was taken. Okay, I want to point that out because there's a lot of charlatans in our industry that sell fertilizer based upon tissue tests. And I've mentioned this before, tissue tests will change based upon seasons. I've done a fair amount of work on this. And the same quality level for, say, Bermuda grass in June of, let's say, 2018. Okay, my range for an adequate level of potassium for this quality Bermuda grass was, let's say, 1 to 1.5 or whatever percent in June. The very next June, it'll change. It might change. It might go down. So the adequate level for June might actually be lower for the next year. And that's what these authors are showing right here, is that you'll see that's not exactly what they're showing, but they're showing that it changes from season to season, even from year to year, it'll change. So the concept of using a set tissue analysis, a set range of tissue concentration as a means to recommend applying fertilizer, there's not a lot to support that because the variation is so great. I don't have a lot of confidence saying your potassium should be 1.5. And if it's below 1.5, then you need to apply potassium for Bermuda grass or whatever. And it should be 2.5 for bent grass or whatever, you know, whatever the number is. Well, when was it taken? What month was it taken? There's all sorts of variations in this that lead me to be convinced that using tissue analysis is not a best management practice when it comes to recommending fertilizer applications. You can use tissue analysis in some cases to further drill down to diagnose issues if you have yet to find your issue. It can be used in some cases, but to recommend fertilizer applications, in my opinion, we're nowhere near that level of confidence to provide that. And my voice is starting to go, and it's 1 hour, so I got to move. Seems like it always happens about 1 hour. Okay, let's look at the, I'm going to look at these graphs down here, and then I'm going to come back to that yellow, and then I'm done. Now, oh wait, I didn't want to go over that yet. Okay, I got that. Okay. The tissue concentration is on the x-axis now, and clipping dry matter yields on the y-axis. And the R of this particular, I'm going to have to take a lozenge. Sorry, guys. The R is 0.027, meaning there is really no relationship. Okay, this big grouping of data points says that your tissue concentration can be a variety of different levels, and your clipping dry matter yield is going to be a variety on that. I mean, there's no way to predict what your clipping dry matter will be based upon the tissue potassium concentration in this particular graph using this particular study, okay? It ranged from as low as 1% to as high as just below 6%, but yeah, you know, really, we have 1 point way out there. It was really the majority was between, say, 1.8, 1.9% and 4%. That's where everything landed. And we can't with really any confidence say that, yeah, if you're at 2%, then your dry matter yield is going to be this. And you should increase it to 4% and you're going to increase dry matter yield. We can't say that. This is pretty clear in this graph. Okay. Nor can we say the quality is going to change. So the panel above here is the same tissue potassium concentrations going from 0 to 6%. And we see the quality ratings go from 3 all the way up to 7. So you're all these threes here, what this is saying is these are all unacceptable. So everything from here down are all unacceptable turf grasses. And look at the tissue concentration. It ranges from 1% all the way out to 5%, basically. So all of this tissue, or all this turf grass, is unacceptable. And it had the same general range of potassium concentrations as all of this did up here, above 6. Does that make sense? So your potassium can be 2, and you can have great turf, or you can have bad turf. It can be 4, and you can have acceptable turf, or you can have unacceptable turf. Okay? An R of 0.007. That means there is basically, we have zero confidence at predicting what your turf quality will be based upon your turf grass tissue potassium concentrations. It's that simple. So when you go out and you take these samples, or someone's sampling your putting greens and they're sending it off somewhere and they say, oh, we'll do a tissue analysis and we'll give you a whole recommendation, fertilizer recommendation and application. Just know, there's essentially no evidence to support that at all. And there's very good evidence to refute that. I mean, granted, this is not a putting green grass, but I will go over putting green potassium. And it's not going to change. It's really not going to change. You can have really good looking turf with a little potassium or really good looking turf with a lot of potassium. There's really not an influence there. Okay, and that's what these two graphs show. Dry matter yield doesn't change that much based upon tissue concentration. Quality ratings don't change that much based upon tissue concentration. We can't say you should increase your potassium in your tissue and you're going to see an increase in quality. We can't say that, at least not from this paper. Okay. Sorry, I keep clearing my throat, but it's starting to go. Okay. Now, he goes in and says, let's see. Okay, in our study, we did not observe a potassium and nitrogen interaction yield response with phosphorus applied at 1 pound to plots that initially had medium availability of phosphorus. However, we did observe a slight but significant decrease in quality as potassium rates increased at the highest rate, which is what I mentioned. Now, he goes in and tries to explain this. The lack of positive yield response or quality response of Kentucky bluegrass to potassium fertilization on our sandy loam soil with low potassium levels may underestimate the relation, or the soil test may underestimate the relationship between extractable potassium and expected. Oh, wait. On our sandy loam was, oh, okay. Had two suggestions. One, our current soil test ratings relative to the actual concentrations may underestimate the relationship between extractable potassium and expected turf response, which is true. This happens almost every time we do a correlation or calibration with soil tests with turf grass. It always ends up being lower than what the existing soil test interpretation was. I haven't yet to see an interpretation where we ended up moving the number up. It's almost always reducing the number down because turf grass has a greater capacity, apparently, of harvesting those nutrients out of the soil. So the nutrients in the soil don't need to be as high as, say, ag crops. They can be lower and still have perfectly acceptable turf. Or number two, another explanation was potassium from sources other than extractable forms was being supplied to the soil. So that's what I mentioned at the very beginning when it comes to primary minerals and sources that are not measured on the soil test. A second more probable explanation, however, is that a substantial amount of potassium was being supplied from non-exchangeable forms in the soil. Samples from the plot area produced a mean non-exchangeable soil potassium concentration of 548 parts per million. This is non-exchangeable. This suggests that a large amount of potassium could become plant available in this soil, even if a small percentage of the non-exchangeable potassium was released through the growing season. And then he goes through and says, additionally, X-ray diffraction analysis indicate the soil had a rooting depth. The soil at the rooting depth was dominated by potassium-bearing feldspars. And says data not shown. For those of you who may not be familiar with X-ray diffraction, basically, when we're trying to figure out the mineralogy of a soil, each mineral has a very specific signature. When you shoot X-rays at it and it diffracts off the mineral, it'll diffract at a very specific, basically like a fingerprint precision. And they went in, they didn't show the data, but they went in and they actually did an X-ray diffraction on this soil and found that there were potassium-bearing feldspars in this soil. Okay. The mineralogy analysis of sand fractions taken previously at the same site indicated that the mineral composition was approximately 50% feldspars, 2% muscovites, are both potassium-bearing minerals. So there were potassium-bearing minerals in the soil, and their argument is, it's possible that some of the potassium, even though it didn't show up on a soil test, was released in the soil. And I would say that since then, that postulate has been strengthening and strengthening in our literature. It's very likely that even though soil test is low in potassium, if you have potassium-bearing minerals in your soil, they're releasing potassium at a greater rate than we previously anticipated and supplying your turf grass with potassium that may not have shown up on a soil test. Which is, well, I'll go into that in soil test later. Okay. I'm going to go down to the yellow because I'm running out of time. Although there was no yield or quality response to potassium fertilization, we did observe responses to potassium for the nitrogen utilization indices of apparent recovery and use efficiency for all but the highest N rate. Response surfaces indicated that the greatest recovery and use efficiency occurred at the lowest rates of nitrogen with the highest rates of potassium. We could find no other report. The positive effect of increasing potassium on both in recovery or use efficiency at the lower in rate may have been influenced by the effect of potassium fertilization on root development. Now, they postulate that the increased nitrogen use efficiency apparent in recovery as a result of potassium was a result potentially of increased root growth. They didn't measure root growth, and they mentioned that. We don't know, but it possibly is root growth. I'm going to get to my argument just after I show these graphs. So we're looking at in rate on one axis, K rate on the other axis, and apparent in recovery, just like we did before. And we'll notice that the in recovery stays flat when you increase the nitrogen from 0 to 6 pounds an in. Okay. Stays pretty flat. At the very low in rate, say 2 pounds in, as you increase potassium, the in rate recovery goes up from 35-ish to 55-ish. So you're recovering more nitrogen following the application of potassium at the low in rate, but not so much at the high in rate, which is over here. And the same, this is apparent in recovery, and then nitrogen use efficiency is a kind of a similar graph where you see as you increase potassium at a low amount of nitrogen, you see this increase from 6 grams of dry matter per gram in all the way up to 12. So you're doubling it. And they postulate that could be due to increased rooting, and they have some other speculations in there as well. Now, 20 years ago, I would have probably thought the same thing. I would probably, well, it's possible that could have happened and that you took up more nitrogen because you have increased rooting. We didn't measure rooting, but it's possible. But now, looking back, we can see a little more clear what was going on with the sulfur depositions. It's been declining since the 80s to the point now where there's essentially no value to any deposition of sulfur in the rainfall. It's so little, it's insignificant. But we were in the 20 years ago, it was still coming down. And it hadn't really, the idea of sulfur deficiencies in turf grass, it was really not even a second thought to us. It wasn't on the forefront of our minds because we never saw it. It was never really an issue because there was so much sulfur available from rainfall. You would never see a response to applying more of it. But this was right at the time where they had already started reducing emissions and the sulfur depositions had been starting to decline. So I would argue that their increase in apparent nitrogen recovery and nitrogen use efficiency possibly could have come from the addition of sulfate from the potassium sulfate. Remember, they used potassium sulfate, not potassium chloride. And they didn't balance out the sulfate from the other treatments, nor would have I probably back then, because it wasn't really a concern. We didn't think the sulfur could have confounded our results. But if I were to go back and redo this again, and I think if the authors were to go back and do this again, they might concede that, you know, in fact, it could have been sulfate that was actually providing a little bit of sulfate that increased a little bit more of the nitrogen being taken up into the plant. It's possible. We don't know. They don't know. It could have been from the roots that they speculated that maybe it was root increase that they didn't measure it, but it could have been from that too. No one really knows. But because they use potassium sulfate, I can't rule that out as a potential explanation as to why more nitrogen was taken up when greater potassium was increased. So what I'm getting at is I wouldn't go out and assume applying more and more potassium is going to increase more nitrogen uptake yet. I wouldn't do that because there could have been a confounding issue that we didn't account for, that being the sulfur. So if you use potassium chloride, would you have seen the same result? We don't know. That's the only way to have known for sure that it was from the sulfate is if you applied a potassium source with no sulfate, okay? But that would be my take on that. I suspect it's probably from the sulfate, not from some increase in rooting, but I could be wrong. You know, they could be correct. I don't know. Now the conclusions, and we're done. You're gonna see this a lot throughout this whole month. Okay? Like, I'm gonna get a scoreboard and put it up here next. I'll have to figure out some way to create it and put it on the screen. Now, how many times we say the same thing over and over and over here? There were no positive Kentucky bluegrass yield or quality responses to potassium fertilization, even though initial soil extractable potassium concentrations were considered low. I mean, that's a great first sentence to a conclusion. Maybe grammatically it could be. Some grammar teacher might nitpick that apart, but I like that sentence. Straightforward. That's what they found. There was no positive effect. Relatively high tissue concentrations suggest that sufficient soil K was available to meet the requirements for Kentucky bluegrass growth and quality at this site without potassium fertilization. Okay? So potassium in the tissue was high enough even without potassium fertilization. If the potassium in the tissue had declined down to, say, you know, 0.5% or something, that level would probably be concerning. Generally, we, you know, 1 to 1.5% is generally considered sufficient in most turf grasses. But we didn't see, they didn't see that. They only had one data point out of hundreds that was even less than one, and it was just slightly less than one. Okay. So there's still plenty of potassium in the turf grass tissue for adequate turf growth, even without potassium fertilization. The inclusion of a portion of non-exchangeable potassium amount of the non-exchangeable potassium amount with the extractable potassium levels to estimate potassium availability to Kentucky bluegrass may be warranted for our sandy loam soil. So in other words, not just the soil test, but we have to account for the non-exchangeable and the primary minerals. It may be warranted. Increasing the K rate relative to the N rate may help to reduce the threat of N pollution by increasing N recovery and use efficiency. So I would say that that's the part I would be careful with, because it might not be from the potassium. It existed from potassium sulfate, but we weren't. They didn't partition out the differences between those two elements. They probably didn't expect that to happen. Who knows? And then they found it, and now the study's already done, and you know it is what it is. But I would not walk away from this and say, "Oh, we should apply potassium. It's going to increase the nitrogen we take up." Well, no. Let's get through the. Remember, not one paper. Don't base your confidence on one paper. That's the reason I go over many, many papers on one topic, and then we try to, you know, come up with the best management practice based upon as much evidence as we can go over. Okay, guys. So that's this paper. So the short and skinny of it is the conclusions of this paper or this is that there was no beneficial response in terms of quality or yield when they apply potassium. They actually found that the tissue concentration of potassium was high enough, even when no potassium was applied, to sustain adequate turf grass growth and quality. So there was no benefit to, they didn't need to apply it. And the likelihood or the probability that that occurred was possibly due to potassium bearing minerals in the soils already, which exist all over the place. Okay. If you're in a putting green and you go, "Well, I got that, Travis, but I'm not a native soils. I'm on putting green." If you're top dressing with soil, with sand that has potassium bearing minerals in there, then you're applying potassium. You may not know it. In fact, I would bet money that you don't know it. You know, you have to actually do an X-ray diffraction or a potassium analysis on that top dressing sand to see what potassium bearing minerals are in there. And you might be applying who knows how much potassium in your top dressing sand. So you don't need to continue to apply more potassium. And I'm going to show a paper that says exactly that. It concludes exactly that, is that when you're applying top dressing sands with potassium bearing minerals, even on low K soils like putting greens, it's very likely, if not probable, that you're supplying more than enough potassium to sustain turf grass growth, and applying more potassium might actually increase your risk of some diseases. Okay? I don't see anything on the, here we go. Jonathan Tierman. Your thoughts on applications of potassium to sandy soils high in sodium, okay, due to poor irrigation quality water. I wasn't going to go into that as a potential benefit in high sodium situations. Like if your irrigation water is high in sodium, I really wasn't going to go into that per se. I'd be more comfortable answering that question after a little while. I mean, let me. I haven't reviewed that literature in a few minutes. It's been a while. But before I give an answer on that, I'd rather show an article on that issue before I go into it. I know the idea is that in locations where you're applying sodium in the irrigation water, you can apply other cations to compete with that sodium, and the turf grass might not have that exposure to sodium at a toxic level because there's more potassium or more calcium or whatever in the sodium that might be toxic to roots would be less toxic to roots. And there's some evidence to support that. I'll just say that. I'll say that there's some evidence to support the use of potassium in locations where sodium is high. And if the sodium is high, and you mentioned sandy soil, so and sodium is high in sandy soil, so it's not going to cause a structural issue, but it might cause a toxicity issue to the plant. And there is some evidence supporting potassium and other cations to reduce that toxicity. And Mr. Jackson, thank you for coming here today. I'm so horrible with names. He says, I really appreciate what you're doing. I appreciate you. I appreciate you for watching. Thank you. And that's about it. So tomorrow I will be gone. I'm not here tomorrow. So don't expect me on tomorrow. Wednesday morning will be the next show at 10 a.m. Eastern time. And I'm still up in the air whether I switch the Wednesday to Thursday this week or not. I'll see what happens. It might be Thursday night this week, but we'll see. Okay. That's all I got today, guys. I appreciate everybody showing up. Don't forget, listen to the podcast on all the podcast platforms. And if you want some interaction with me personally, want to help you out, I do my consultation through calendly.com/Travis Shaddix. I'm going to leave you today with one of my favorite blues guitarists. She happens to be a female, one of the few female blues guitarists. This is an older song, but it's one of her songs off her first big album. So appreciate everybody. I'll see you on Wednesday morning. Until then, be kind.